Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Tonight we're very pleased to welcome back to the store Senator Gary Hart. Hart served as a United States Senator representing Colorado from 1975 to 1987. After his Senate service, he certainly never slowed down. He resumed his law practice, served in many advisory capacities, became a blogger for the Huffington Post, and became the U.S. Special Envoy to Northern Ireland. He wrote 5 fiction and 16 nonfiction books, among many other things, and that is crazy impressive to think about. And we're very excited to have him here tonight to discuss and sign his latest book, The Republic of Conscience. Please join me in welcoming Senator Gary Hart.
Thank you very much. I am deeply appreciative of all of you taking time to be here this evening. A few of you here have had to listen to me on more than one political occasion and probably even more than one book occasion. I am even more indebted to Tattered Cover. I tried to remember on the way here tonight how many books I have described or presented at one or the other of the Tattered Cover bookstores over the years. I remember fondly when Joyce opened her first store in Cherry Creek, and it was a very, very small store. And very quickly, she and those around her and the book readers of Denver made this, I think, the best bookstore in America, and it continues to be. Booksellers don't do well unless they're book readers, and I hope your presence here this evening indicates that you are book readers. I was also thinking about how many books I have bought here. And it brought to mind a somewhat analogous statement that Winston Churchill once made about whiskey. And one evening, he was seated next to a grand dame who took him to task and said, "Winston, why do you drink so much?" And he said, "Madam, I have taken more out of whiskey than whiskey has taken out of me." And this is true of me and Tattered Cover. The book, the latest book, Republic of Conscience, is a reflection on the founders of this country, particularly at this season of our independence celebration. And I've tried to think if the people who created this nation were to return to 21st century America, what they would think of what we have done with their creation. If you stop 10 Denverites outside on the street and ask them what kind of country this is, 9 or 10 would say a democracy, and they would be right. But many of you have read, as I have, the debates and the correspondence of those founders. And they used the language of the Republic. And they did so consciously because they were classicists. Many of them could read in classical Greek and Latin. And they read the ancient philosophers who wrote about this new form of government from Athens forward to Rome and beyond, as a republic. And that's what they wanted to create in this country. Democracies are about rights, and we have spent 230 years trying to expand rights in this country. We haven't perfected them. But where minorities are concerned, women, others who have been left out, particularly African Americans, we have made great improvement, and I acknowledge that in this book. But what is a republic, and how is it different from a democracy? A republic has a lot to do with duties. we have spent, as and we rightly should, decades, centuries, trying to expand equality and freedom and rights. In the process, I think, we have lost sight of the qualities of the republic that our founders created. Throughout history, republics have had four common qualities. First is the notion of popular sovereignty. No king, no potentate, no ruler, no power in an individual. Power belongs to the people. Or, as the Black Panthers put it some years ago, power to the people. They didn't know it, probably, but they were quoting ancient Athenians. The sovereignty or the power of the nation belongs to us. That's point number one. They also, ancient Republicans, small r, focused on what they called civic virtue. Today we would call it participation, citizen duty. Participating in the life of the community, the state, and the nation. Paying attention, learning the issues, reading the newspapers, so long as they don't all disappear. There were more newspapers in America at the founding era among 3 million people than there are today among 300 million people. And people read those newspapers and they discussed them. They discussed the issues. Civic virtue, participation, going to town hall meetings, coming to the tattered cover bookstore. This is civic virtue. This is citizen participation. I was interviewed today by a prominent radio personality syndicated around the country. And he said to his four children, ranging in age from teens up until early 20s, simply didn't pay any attention at all. They were turned off to government politics and so forth. That's a shame. And to the degree it reflects a younger generation, it's a serious issue for our country. So popular sovereignty, civic virtue. Third, a sense of the commonwealth. Today we would call it the national interest. But they used the language of the commonwealth or the common good. What is that? Well, get a piece of paper and write down all the things we have in common. Transportation systems, in no particular order. Here in the West, natural resources, recreation areas, wilderness areas, parks, waterways, the air and the water, the air that we breathe, the water that we drink. This is part of the common good, part of the commonwealth. The list goes on. We have a lot more that we own in common than what we each own individually. And that is not really taught, particularly in an era in which so many political figures focus on getting rid of government, privatizing everything, turning everything over to profit makers. That's destroying the commonwealth and the common good. But it's part of being a republic, and we still call ourselves a republic. The fourth quality is the one I want to talk about briefly tonight, because that's what the book is about. Ancient Greeks and Romans and the founders of America said the only thing that would destroy the American Republic was corruption. And so people in a republic had to resist corruption. Again, if you went outside and stopped 10 people and said, What is political corruption? They would say bribery. That's not what the founders meant. They define corruption as putting special, narrow, or personal interests ahead of the common good. Putting special interests ahead of the national interest and the common good. If you apply that standard to 21st century American government, we are massively corrupt. And that's what the book talks about. Why is this? Well, in contrast to the years in which I served this state, and I hope the nation, in the 70s and 80s in the Senate, the industry of lobbying has exploded in Washington. It's literally exploded. There is over $4 billion a year spent on lobbying members of Congress and the administration for special interests. Over 400 former members of Congress are now active lobbyists. What that means is that a title that the voters have given to that individual, senator or congressperson, member of the House of Representatives, is being traded in the marketplace for money. They are not being hired by the lobbying firms because they're nice people, necessarily. They're being hired for their connections among the people that with whom they used to serve. So they can open doors, they can get telephone calls answered, and it's in the interest of a commercial interest, a corporation, an organization, an industry group, a labor union, teachers, airline pilots, you name it. Pick up the Washington, D.C. phone directory, look under the A's and the F's, and you will find column after column after column of American Association of something, or federal organization of something, or the ends, national organization of something. Columns. Those are almost all lobbying organizations. We belong to many of them. Many of us belong to them. AARP, American Automobile Association. We pay our dues. Those go into the pockets of lobbyists who get something from the federal government. It's not all bad. Some of it's beneficial, not only to that group, but occasionally to the nation. But it's overwhelming the system. And members of Congress who are seeking re-election, and I'll come back to that, pay attention to the people who are financing their campaigns. And guess what? It is those lobbying organizations that are raising money for the re-election of those candidates. Now, I'll just take a moment to explain how this has exploded in the last 30 years. Not very long period of time in this nation's history. I'll have to make personal reference just to give you a sense of the scope and scale. When I was fortunate enough to be elected to the Senate at a pretty young age, 1974, my party had six candidates for the nomination, and the winner of that nomination had to compete in the general election with a two-term incumbent. The whole campaign, beginning to end, cost $375,000, average contribution $17. A year, 6 years later, I ran for re-election, was fortunate enough to win, but I had to spend three times that amount, close to $1 million, and I was outspent, still able to prevail. The last Senate campaign last year in this state, I think each of the contestants spent well over $25 million. This is a state of 5 million people. Now go to California, New York, Florida, Texas, and you're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. And candidates for the presidency in 2016 are talking about raising and spending $1 billion to $2.5 billion to be elected president. It's out of hand. It's out of hand, and that fundraising is integrated with this explosion of the lobbying industry. The founders said, our republic will become corrupt when we put special interests ahead of the common good. That's the concern. Finally, this combination of the gigantic lobbying industry in Washington and the campaign financing has created a closed system in our capital that ordinary Americans don't feel that they can have any impact on whatsoever, because it's so big and it's so tightly controlled, and you have to be part of that system to have an impact, that most of us, I don't know, 90, 95% of the people in this country, just feel helpless and don't know what to do about that. And that causes loss of confidence in our government. And when American citizens lose confidence in their government, we have real problems. Now, we've got tea parties, we've got occupiers, protests of one kind or another. The worst thing is when people quit protesting and simply, as that interviewer's children, just tune out. Don't pay attention and don't care. That turns over all of the power of government, not to the people, but to those special interests controlling the campaign contributions. When I went to the Senate in 1975, a very wise man, there were quite a few of them at that time, and none of them, by the way, became lobbyists. Not one of the great senators of both parties that I served with in the 70s and the early 80s walked out the door and joined a lobbying firm or a law firm that lobbied. I wouldn't say it was beneath them, but they did feel that the voters had not given them the title of senator so that they could convert that into great wealth. And they didn't. And, by the way, neither have I. I have not made 10 cents lobbying, and I never will. I don't believe it is right. So if it's corrupt, why aren't people going to jail? Well, guess what? It's legal. Legal corruption. And it just got more legal last year when the Supreme Court of the United States, in a decision called Citizens United, said that a corporation, which those of us who went to law school learned year one, is a legal fiction, that a corporation has the same rights of free speech under the First Amendment as you and I do, which means that that wealthy corporation, Fortune 500, can spend any amount of money it wants to influence the government of the United States in its own special interest. If that decision isn't overturned in a future court that I hope will come pretty quickly, then we will have massively legal corruption. So that's step number one. I think there ought to be restrictions on members of Congress leaving office and becoming lobbyists, one for 1 year or 2 years or 5 years, as far as I'm concerned, 50 years. In any case, they shouldn't be able to walk out the door and pocket hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, based on the office that they occupied. I don't want people, when they hear this one man's opinion about what's going on, to despair. This is not a pessimistic book. It is a book that I hope will alert people like you that will take time out to come to a discussion like this about the state of affairs from the point of view of somebody who's been either involved or watching very closely for most of my adult life about what has gone on, and it's not part of what our founders wanted for us. This is what they warned us against. If you remember that famous quote that Ben Franklin walking out of the Constitutional Convention was stopped by a citizen saying, "Mr. Franklin, what is it you're creating?" He said, "A republic if you can keep it," meaning if you don't let it succumb to corruption, the corruption that they warned us against, special interest over the national interest. Finally, on the campaign finance front, I mentioned one of the great senators is a man named Abe Ribicoff of Connecticut. I served with Senator Ribicoff for 12 years. Great statesman, like many of the others. He took me aside when I first got there, and he said, okay, if you like it here and you want to get reelected, I'll tell you how to do it. The first year in office, go back home all the time, and your constituents will say, isn't that amazing? We just elected this chap to the Senate, and here he is. He hasn't forgotten about us. And that will impress them. Then he said, in the second, third, and fourth year, travel. Go around the world. Learn what's going on. It will help you do your job. Then he said, in the fifth year, go back home all the time. And your constituents will say, well, he's not running. Why is he back here with us all the time? And then you'll coast into the reelection in the sixth year. A well-known senator, more than one, has said to me today, I mean, in the recent days, every day he is in office, starting in year one, he walks off the Capitol grounds to the headquarters of the Democratic or Republican National Committee and for 2 hours makes phone calls for money. Year one. It goes on to year two, year three, year four, year five, year six. 2 hours a day raising money. Now, 90% of that money goes to television advertising, so the networks aren't complaining too much about it. Occasionally, you'll get a TV editorial saying, oh, aren't we spending too much money on politics, even as that money goes into the network coffers. But there's something wrong with this system. For 6 years, a six-year term, you're supposed to become a statesman or a stateswoman. You're supposed to think about the national interest. You're supposed to pay attention to what's best for this country and its future. If you're raising money for 2 hours a day on the phone, begging for money, you're not doing your job. And you're part of that corruption. So, at the risk of ending these remarks on a less than hopeful note, we all have to do something about this. We have to treat it seriously. We have to take it up with our elected officials or those running for office. Ask candidates. And by the way, this isn't just Washington. This is state capitals, sometimes city governments, that are being heavily lobbied for one interest or another. It's legal. It's not illegal. It's legal. It just happens to be wrong. As I say in the book, just because something is legal doesn't make it right. So insist when you talk to your candidates for all these offices, if you get a chance to talk to a presidential candidate, ask the question, are you taking special interest money? It will embarrass them. They'll have to say yes. I think one candidate has said he would not take PAC or Political Action Committee money. I did the same thing when I ran for national office in 1984. I think I was the first to refuse to take Political Action Committee money because I saw this trend beginning even then. And it was dangerous. But it's 10, 20, 100 times bigger now. So it's up to you. The first quality of a republic is popular sovereignty. You have the power. Thank you very much. Now it's confession time, and since I'm the oldest person in the room, I can say very candidly to you that when your hair turns white, you lose part of your hearing. So if those of you in the back have a comment or a question, and you speak like this, so shout it out. Either I will repeat the question if I can hear it, or some of my younger helpers will. The question had to do with a endorsement of Senator Sanders over other candidates for the Democratic nomination, including the front so-called front runner. My experience, this was so long ago, none of you will remember, but about this time in the six-candidate field, 1984 for the nomination, to run against the incumbent President Reagan, I think I was peeking out at about 2% in the polls, and most of those were my relatives. Then came Iowa, and by the way, just to refresh your recollection, we were not only competing with the front-runner former Vice President of the United States, Walter Mondale, but there was another candidate in that race who was one of the most popular Americans in the world, a man called John Glenn. So here is poor Gary Hart from Colorado running against the former vice president and the world's greatest astronaut. Anyway, we got to Iowa, and with the help of a lot of very hardworking volunteers, I came in a distant second, and then 2 weeks later won the New Hampshire primary pretty solidly. And that campaign then went all the way to the convention. Well, all of that to say, the polls at this point mean very little. They mean very little. Again, they are random surveys of 500 or so people with a list of names. A good number of those people are going to pick the name they've heard of. They haven't paid all that much attention. So if they see Clinton or Bush, they're probably going to say Clinton or Bush, just because that's who they remember. Let's wait until the voters of these states are heard from. It's not only Bernie Sanders, who is making a populist appeal, and by the way, I think also refusing to take political action committee money. There's a friend of ours, Governor O'Malley of Maryland, who deserves to be heard. Was a very good mayor of Baltimore, a very good governor of Maryland. New generation deserves to be heard. He hasn't gotten the attention that Senator Sanders has. There's a former senator named Jim Webb, who is quite a distinguished man. I think he announced for the presidency. And there may be two or three others. So let's not give the nomination away in either party to just the best-known person. There are a lot of Americans concerned about this system that I talked about, narrowing the field of candidates to those who already have a Rolodex, already have a, I've forgotten the word that you used, a system or a base. We shouldn't, in a country of 330 million people, narrow the field down immediately to two families. And I've known President Clinton and Mrs. Clinton for 40 years and admire them and respect them, but they are not entitled to the presidency. And there will have been a Clinton on the national ticket in four campaigns, and there will have been a Bush on a Republican ticket or a candidacy for eight or nine campaigns. So let's open this up. Let's look at everybody. Now, having said that, somebody's going to say, well, look at all the candidates on the Republican side. Good. That's good. What's not good is when the ones who are not as well known go shopping for a billionaire to sponsor them. And three or four of the billionaires, including the Koch brothers, hold their own primaries. And the casino operator and two or three others summon these candidates to their, wherever their villas are, and have them perform. And the one that performs the best according to their desires, their special interests, gets the support of the billionaire. I say in the book, if this goes on, candidates for office should wear, like race car drivers, the logos of their sponsors. So you know who's financing it. Yes. They make $2.5 million over 6 years?
I think so.
What Senate are they serving in?
About $170,000 a year or whatever.
I'll do the math later, but I don't think it comes to $2.5 million. At least. Okay. Well, I suppose. Yeah, I don't think it ought to cost $25 million to run for the Senate. I've indicated that. The other thing, and if you're talking about reforms, most Americans don't think about this. NBC, CBS, Fox, and the rest do not own the airwaves. We own the airwaves. They belong to the people of the United States. Talk about the common good. We license them to the networks so that they can put often not very good programming on that people don't want to watch and raise money through advertising. We can legally insist that the licensees of the airwaves, television and radio, make a limited amount of time available for qualified candidates. Not my Uncle Fred. I mean, you'd have to have a threshold. Otherwise, everybody and his brother would be running for president so he could get on television. You'd have to have a threshold to qualify to get that free, limited free media time. That would do more to reduce the cost of campaigning than anything I can think of. And we ought to insist on it. You say, well, that makes sense. Why don't we? The television lobby in Washington. The cat chasing its tail. The television lobby in Washington is so powerful, you're not about to get legislation passed giving candidates for national office time on television, which almost every democracy in the world provides, except ours. I'll go back and do the math, but in the 12 years I was there, I don't remember making $2.5 million. But yes, sir.
The
situation you have described is clearly an oligarchy, and yet you say we live in a democracy. But if votes can be bought, what's the difference if we can vote for whomever we want if that vote can be bought? Where does democracy go? It evaporates.
Well, I've never accused anyone of buying or selling votes. It's more complicated than that. What is being bought with the money is access. Access. All right, let's say you are a member of Congress. You have 24 hours in the day. Let's say 12 of those you're in your office or doing your job. And you have to, every 15 to 30 minute segment of that 12 hours is parceled out every day by a schedule this long. Now, let's say you have to decide in the 2 to 2:30 time slot whether to see Mr. and Mrs. Johnson from Colorado or Mr. Big Bucks, who just delivered $250,000 in checks to your campaign. That's the choice. Who do you think you see? Now, I don't say this is everybody. There are some very, very honest, decent people, overwhelming majority in the Congress. But it's access, and it's intricate, and it's subtle, and it's the phone call you take. It's the time you spend. It's the reception you go to for that person's business or corporation or group. It's just the way the system works. I don't think, I quote there, one of the lines you hear when you go back, at least I did in my day, was the unnamed, always Southern senator for some reason, I don't know why, who was accused of selling his vote. And his response was, if I can't eat their food and drink their whiskey and vote against them, then I shouldn't be here. Everybody laughed. Meaning, I'm strong enough to be pals with these people, and if I don't like what they want, I'm not going to vote for it. Well, let's hope that's what most people do, and I hope they do. But the money is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I don't care who it is, any candidate for president saying, I'm going to raise and spend, or the people around them, I'm going to raise and spend $1 to $2.5 billion. That's not coming from small contributors. That's not coming from small contributors. Yes, sir.
Democracy depends on participation, you said. But in the United States, we have a two-chamber system, and the identical election law is used, majority votes. In some other countries, the Senate is majority, but the Congress is proportional, meaning you serve minorities. But in this country, you have both times majority votes, which actually excludes the non-majority parties. What do you think how we can increase the participation with changing the law, as in many other countries where they also have a two-chamber system, but one Senate majority, and for the House, it is proportional, meaning you favor minorities?
Well, long, complicated question. It has to do really contrasting the U.S. system with many European systems in which there are multiple parties, and minor parties are represented in the assembly or parliament or whatever. Pros and cons. We have two major parties. The laws of each of the 50 states permit third or fourth parties, if they reach a certain threshold of votes in the previous election. Now, this again is a cat chasing its tail. How do you get to be even a recognized party? How do you meet the threshold to become a minority party? It's very difficult. The exceptions, of course, are Ralph Nader, Mr. I'm having a senior moment. Ross Perot, thank you. Also comes with the gray hair. Ross Perot, who was a wealthy man, Nader was not. So again, I assume if one of the Koch brothers wanted to run for president, he could figure out a way to get on the ballot in enough states. The dark side of multiple parties is all the deals are made behind closed doors. Putting a government together, let's say in Israel or somewhere else, where you don't have a winning majority party, the leading candidate is asked by the president of the country to form a government, meaning he or she goes to those minority parties and makes deals. You can have the Ministry of Finance if you will join the ruling coalition, or you can have transportation, or you get this or that, but it's all done behind closed doors. The citizens are not party to those negotiations forming that coalition government. I don't like that system. A lot to be said about our two-party system in this country and particularly how negative that's become. But the alternative of multi-parties opens up a lot more complications in terms of forming a government. Now, you're really talking about minority parties in Congress. Again, it's not prohibited. It's possible. But what you're dealing with are those 50 state laws that each individually require a certain threshold of votes to get on the next ballot. And so it's unless you're wealthy, it's almost an impossible situation. It's worth a lot of PhD dissertations have been written on this, and I haven't really addressed the problem. But it's more complicated than just let's have more minority parties and seat them in the parliament. Yes. No, I understand. It's a very good question for those in the back. How do you keep lobbying honest and legitimate when there are cases to be made and members of Congress, elected officials, need to hear those cases? Well, as I said earlier, lobbying has never been illegal, to my knowledge, in this country. It's when it gets out of hand. And now, in the current, we have had financial and political scandals throughout American history. The Teapot Dome, American historians, probably people here, could list a dozen periods of time in American history. Certainly Arthur Schlesinger documented many of these. They all lead to a cycle of reform and change, and then we get back into another scandal of one kind or another. It's human nature and it's human greed. But the ability of interest groups to petition their elected officials has always been recognized. There has always been, to my knowledge, in the Capitol, in both houses, a lobby, literally a room about this big, where you find out there are some people from Colorado there or Mr. Powerhouse from K Street in Washington, who wants to see you. So you walk off the floor and you see the Coloradans or you see the powerful lobbyists. So that goes on. It's not illegal. It's when it's gotten so big, when it begins to employ hundreds of members, former members of Congress. That becomes very incestuous because they're trading on their friendships and their contact with each other and doing each other favors. And then you put on top of that the astronomical costs of campaigning, where I'll tell you a story. True story. Happens to be true. I had a staff member who, when occasionally we'd resolve a problem, and I'd say, okay, here's what I'm going to say. And he said, that has the added advantage of being true. In 1979, I date this as the beginning of the era of corruption. A group of Coloradans came to see me. I wish I could remember what it was, rural electrification or something really mainstream. And their Washington representative of their organization brought them in. We had a nice conversation. They left, 12 or 15 people. And my administrative assistant came in and handed me an envelope, plain white envelope. So I opened it up. They had left a check for $2,000 for the Hart for Senate Reelection Committee. I was dumbfounded. I gave it to him. I said, run down the hall and give it back to them. Who in the, if their Washington representative told them that they had to pay to come see me, that is outrageous. That is outrageous. And I date this era of corruption to that day because somehow the word was getting around Washington. If you wanted to see your senator or House member, it would be best to leave a check. That's corruption. That is corruption. So if people want to talk to an elected official about preserving the home mortgage deduction on their taxes, fine. That's fine. Don't leave a check. Ed Benton, my old friend Ed Benton.
I would stand if I'm unable. Thomas Jefferson said, if you're going to turn the affairs of the government over to the people, you must have an informed population. Today in this country, we don't have an uninformed populace, we have a misinformed. Avalanche of cable television, talk radio. What is the role of education in your view in the country to combat that condition?
Well, you can't see it, but this is my Declaration of Independence necktie. And that white thing there is Thomas Jefferson's signature. Anyway, Mr. Benton's comment was correctly that Thomas Jefferson said if we wanted to keep our democracy, we had to have an educated public. And that's why he believed very strongly in public education, widespread public education. As I said earlier, people in the founding era read newspapers. They talked. They debated on the streets, coffee shops, whatever. They paid attention. It was called civic virtue. Now we have more information. If the founders were to come back, they'd be dumbfounded by so many things. They'd be dumbfounded by the amount of information we have. But much of it's undigested, or it is partisan. It is tilted by one partisan network or the other to their base or constituency, not to the public at large. Much of the misinformation in this country, I know for a fact, comes out of a specific network that feeds people what they want to hear and misinformation that they continue to recycle. Misinformation. You're absolutely right. It's not just incorrect information. It's conscious misinformation. This is not a healthy situation. There used to be, you'll recall, a rule not a law, but a rule by the FCC, I think, called the Fairness Doctrine. And it said, if you have a license to broadcast from the United States government, television or radio, and you permit somebody to make an argument against something or for something, you have to give more or less equal time to the other side of that case. In 1985, it happened to be President Reagan took away the Fairness Doctrine. That opened the floodgate for partisan media, misinformation, and Thomas Jefferson's nightmare. We are not being well informed. We are being overwhelmed with partisan arguments one way or the other, and point, counterpoint, and all that kind of yelling, but it's not solid information that people can make sound judgments about. Even worse, and like you, I'm very strong for public education and improving it. People are somehow getting out of our students are somehow getting out of our schools without knowing who the president of the United States is, or they can't find Russia on a map, or they never heard of Thomas Jefferson. There's something wrong with this, and we're going to have to fix it. We cannot, as it's been said over and over again, we cannot be ignorant and free. We're either going to be ignorant or we're going to know what we're talking about and be free. One or two more. Yes, sir, back in the back. Question is, term limits, changing the Constitution, one six-year term for president, 1 8-year term for senators, and forget about running for re-election. Again, it's any idea that prevents corruption of our system deserves to be discussed and thought about. I think you have to. We had a term limit movement in this country 20 years ago. I was on the going out the door about the time it came along. It was fascinating because an awful lot of the people who were for term limits, once they got there in the House or the Senate, suddenly decided, gee whiz, this place isn't as bad as I've been telling everybody it was. And I think I'm going to change my mind on term limits. Quite a few of them, and quite interesting in that regard, which leads to that other strange situation where everybody runs against Washington so they can go there. Why? If it's so bad, why go there? Why do you want to go there if it's a terrible place? So I don't know. I'm a kind of constitutional fundamentalist, not a Scalia originalist, but I think there has to be a powerful argument made for changing the fundamental underpinnings of the Constitution. One last question. Question had to comment had to do with newspapers. Somebody told me, I think I mentioned to you that, or I didn't mention to you, the number of newspapers that now routinely review books used to be review sections in all the newspapers. Five newspapers in America routinely review books now, and our hometown paper keeps getting smaller and smaller. I worry about print journalism, because it's an important way of communicating. Finally, let me just say this. Much of what I've said here tonight is negative, and I'm not a negative person. I'm a concerned, deeply, deeply concerned person. I wish I could join a lot of my former colleagues who have just gone home and shut up, and there are an awful lot of people in America who wish I would, but I can't. And I don't care about politics. I care about the country. And if you care about the country, you don't leave that when you walk out of office. So you find a way to talk to young people, to inspire young people. I've been longing for 40 years for a president to do what John Kennedy did for my generation and say that public service is noble. Washington is the capital of our country. Find a way to make a contribution to this nation. We haven't heard that, and I think we need it. We need to recapture some of that idealism, and it's John Kennedy used the image of the torch. I think it's all of our duty as we go through life to keep that torch alive and hand it on to the next generation. I greatly appreciate your presence here.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodin. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.